Well, as you find your seats, brethren, turn your Bibles again to Ecclesiastes and chapter 8. And having looked at verse 1 last week, we come to verses 2 to 9 this week. Now, let me just say something very quickly by way of introduction before we read our text. I mentioned last week that while verse 1 fits best with the end of chapter 7, it also serves as a nice introduction to chapter 8. In verse 1, Solomon has told us how wisdom influences or impacts the individual. If you remember, it enables us, verse 1, to know the interpretation of a thing. That is, it enables us, wisdom, to rightly interpret the word, but here, especially the works of God. It enables us to make sense, to interpret the world around us. And secondly, it makes his face shine. That is, it renders us holy and happy. It causes our souls to shine with the blessedness of God. It makes us morally beautiful and the object of God's favor. And then finally, the sternness of his face is changed. It removes all pride and harshness from us. It enables us now, because we're wise, to look at the world rightly and see that by grace we've been made to differ, and that by nature we're no different or better. Okay, so verse 1, Solomon talks about how wisdom impacts or influences us, the individual. Now what he's going to do, basically to the end of the chapter, or at least through verse 15, is set out three areas wherein wisdom enables us to act rightly. Now, today we're going to cover all the way to verse 9. So from verses 2 to 9, he talks about how wisdom enables us to submit to God-given authority. And then we'll see, God willing, next week in verses 10 to 13, it enables us to relate rightly to God and to fear him. And then, 2 weeks today, God willing, in verses 14 and 15, it enables us to rejoice in God or to rightly use the temporal blessings of God in this world. Okay, so verse 1, wisdom enables us to act rightly, to think rightly with reference to ourselves. God ordained authority. God himself and the worship of God, that is, in fearing him, and to rightly relate to the temporal blessings of this world. That basically takes us to verse 15. We'll see verses 16 and 17. Something of an appendix. All right, so let's read beginning at verse 2. And let me just quickly give you the outline that we're going to use tonight. He tells us, Solomon, in verse 2, to obey the king. And then he's going to give us several reasons why. First, because he possesses power from God, that is the king. Secondly, he's ordained to protect the righteous and punish the wicked. All right, that's basically verses 2 to 9. And then I'll give you the actual divisions here in a moment. Ecclesiastes 8:2. I say, keep the king's commandment for the sake of your oath to God. Do not be hasty to go from his presence. Do not take your stand for an evil thing, for he does whatever pleases him. Where the word of a king is, there is power. And who may say to him, what are you doing? He who keeps his command will experience nothing harmful, and a wise man's heart discerns both time and judgment. Because for every matter, there is a time and judgment, though the misery of man increases greatly. For he does not know what will happen. So who can tell him when it will occur? No one has power over the spirit to retain the spirit, and no one has power in the day of death. There is no release from that war, and wickedness will not deliver those who are given to it. All this I've seen and applied my heart to every work that is done under the sun. There is a time in which one man rules over another to his own hurt. Okay, so the basic theme again here through these verses is submission to God-given authority, and in particular, the king. All right, so notice first, in terms of reasons, he, that is the king, possesses power from God. Verse 2 again, I say, keep the king's commandment for the sake of your oath to God. Now, by king, Solomon is referring to himself and to all lawfully ordained authority who's been given of God. Now, it's true, as the nation of Israel was a theocracy, the king played a unique role in its government. Ultimately speaking, the king in the theocracy in Israel was a picture of Christ, ruling over his old covenant Israel. And so we find in the New Testament, when Jesus comes, he's expressly called the Son of David, who rules over his New Testament Israel. They both ruled from Jerusalem and over the covenant community. But I think it's right, though, to expand our understanding here and to apply the principle to all God-given authority, because remember how Peter puts it even in the New Testament, when he tells us to honor the king. It doesn't mean that we're always going to have a king. It depends on the structure of the government. I'll say a little bit more about this in a minute. But he's talking about God-given authority. So we're not negating that the king in Old Covenant Israel had a unique position and doesn't necessarily come across exactly to the civil magistrate in the New Testament, but there's obvious and evident similarities. Simply put, we're to obey all God-given authority. Notice how he puts it, for the sake, verse 2, of your oath to God. In other words, I think Solomon means this: in light of your covenant relationship to God. Now again, there's unique things happening in the Old Testament, but nevertheless, as New Testament Christians, we can and should apply the principle, ultimately speaking, to Christ, who is our King, but in a more temporal way to the civil magistrate, because we're going to see that Jesus himself is the one who's ordained the civil magistrate as a minister of God. But I do understand for mostly the phrase, for the sake of your oath to God, to refer to motivation. You should obey the king because of your oath to God, because he's God's king, ordained to be a ruler over you. So in light of the fact that you're in covenant with God, your oath to God, you ought to obey the magistrate or the king. And I do think also it underscores limitation. Because you're an oath to God, you should keep the commandment of the king, but you should keep the commandment in the king, a king, mindful that you're foremostly an oath or a covenant with God, or keeping in mind your oath with God. In other words, it's a limitation. So wherever or however the king commands you to act contrary to God or to the scriptures, you have to disobey it. So I do believe that it's foremostly a description of motivation, this phrase, but it's also indicating limitation. Listen to Philip Ryken. He said, the preacher is talking about the divine right of kings, such as the monarchs who ruled over ancient Israel. These principles can also be applied to other forms of government, however, or even more generally to any situation in which we're called to submit to God-given authority. Or else, listen to the Puritan Edward Reynolds. He says, it's necessary to yield obedience unto magistrates, not only out of fear toward them because of their sword, but out of conscience toward God and because of his vows upon us. And yet, We are to keep the king's commandment so that we do not violate our oath and obedience due to God. Okay, so the first reason that we're to obey him is because he possesses power from God. Verse 3, do not be hasty to go from his presence. Do not take your stand for an evil thing, for he does whatever pleases him. Verse 4, where the word of a king is, there is power, and who may say to him, what are you doing? Do not depart from him in reluctance to obey or in disrespect. Honor his presence, I think, is the idea. Don't leave out of his presence in a disorderly, hasty, or disrespectful manner, nor take a stand before him in defiance or disobedience to his rules. The reason being, he does whatever he pleases. Verse 4. I take this to mean that he has power. He's been given authority by God. And thus, you ought to watch the way in which you act in his presence. Philip Ryken again said, in this cultural context, a hasty departure from the throne room was really a sign of disrespect, a way of turning one's back on authority. The preacher isn't saying that we never have a duty to disobey the government in order to fulfill our higher obligation to God, but he is telling us not to be hasty to walk away from any authority that God has put in place. So he's basically telling the same thing that he said back in verse 2, to keep his commandment, that is to honor him, to revere him. Or again, as Peter said in the New Testament, give honor to whom honor is due. Now, obviously, in our culture, none of us have real direct access to the king or to our higher authorities. But nevertheless, the principle is still the same. To speak of them and to deal with them with respect and honor. Why? Because they have power, and this power, as we'll see in a moment, while limited, nevertheless, it's divinely bestowed. All right, now you know this already, but let me just remind you. Turn to the New Testament and to chapter 13 of Romans. And I think here you have a New Testament commentary on Ecclesiastes 8. Verse 1, Romans 13, 1. Let every soul be subject to the governing authorities, for there's no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authority resists the ordinance of God, and those who resist will bring judgment on themselves. So the first reason that we're to obey the king, submit to the king, or honor the king is because he possesses a divinely bestowed authority. Now, brethren, let me just say, too, that this obviously and evidently is true of kings irrespective of their moral character. Remember how David respected and revered Saul, who was very wretched. So we are to obey the king, insofar as his laws or commandments do not force us to disobey God. Because then we know that we're to obey God rather than men. And we're going to talk a little bit about that when we get to verse 9. Okay, so a second reason is found in verse 5a. He protects the righteous. He who keeps his command will experience nothing harmful. Now, obviously, this is a generalization. It's possible that we have to disobey the magistrate, and if we do, we may have to suffer at his hands. But ideally, generally speaking, if you obey the magistrate, you have nothing to fear. You will not be harmed. You will not experience anything harmful. The inference being magistrates exist to punish evildoers and to reward righteous living. Magistrates, the king, these have been ordained of God to punish evildoers. We'll see that here under our third head. And reward righteous living. Now, I've already read from Romans 13. I do want to read a little bit further, but let's back up to a couple of texts in Proverbs and then a few texts in the New Testament that all underscore that the king or the civil magistrates given in the first place to reward righteous living. And then I want to talk just a little bit about how that might show itself. All right, notice Proverbs 14. Let's start there and verse 35. Proverbs 14, 35. The king's favor is toward a wise servant, but his wrath is against him who causes shame. So if a king's favor is toward a wise servant, now just keep in mind that Solomon is the same author of Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. So he's basically saying the same thing here as he says, perhaps less clearly, admittedly, back in Ecclesiastes 8. Remember, we're seeing the manifestations of wisdom in Ecclesiastes 8. And the first manifestation of wisdom is that it rightly obeys or relates itself to the king. Because one, the king's ordained of God, and two, to use the language of verse 35, the king's favor is toward a wise servant. Perhaps I can put it like this. A wise king bestows favor upon a wise servant. Conversely, his wrath is against him who causes shame. We'll see that again under our third point. Look to chapter 16, verse 13. It really starts back up at verse 10, but we're jumping for the sake of time. Proverbs 16, 13, righteous lips are the delight of kings, and they love him who speaks what is right. Now, again, this is ideally speaking. A righteous king, a good king. Solomon was a good king. David was a good king. These kings, we could say, delighted in righteous lips and loved those who spoke what's right. Verse 14. A messenger of death is the king's wrath, but a wise man will appeal it. And the light of the king's face is life. Okay, let me just apply that phrase, first of all, to Jesus. But it also has application and really direct application to the kings of Old Testament Israel, particularly righteous kings, like I've said, David and Solomon and others. In the light of a king's face is life. That is, when you honor the king and obey him, good things come from him. That's what Solomon is saying back in our text, right? And his favor is like a cloud of the latter rain. By the way, that's a good thing. Now you can see, though, how tragic it is. We can just kind of deal with the elephant in the room, how this is so untrue in the case of a people ruled or reigned by an evil king or ruler. But nevertheless, I'm just here at this point setting out God's reasons for civil magistracy. This is why he's ordained it, to prosper the righteous and to punish the wicked. All right, now we have to go to the New Testament and go back to Romans 13. So we read already verses 1 and 2. How about we start at verse 3? For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. Again, idealistically, that first phrase of verse 3 goes back to what I've said already. And then continuing verse 3, do you want to be unafraid of the authority? Do what is good, and you'll have praise from the same. Obey the just laws of the land, and it will go well with you. Verse 4, for he is God's minister to you for good, but if you do evil, be afraid, for he doesn't bear the sword in vain. I'm reading these verses now so we don't have to come back to them under our third head. for he is God's minister to avenge, to execute wrath on him who practices evil. Therefore, you must be subject, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience' sake. Okay. See, I think we're all versed in the fact and understand the truth that the magistrate has a sword to punish evildoers and particularly to execute murderers. But there's a flip side, because the two key texts of the New Testament, this one and the text we're turning to now, 1 Peter chapter 2, underscores a twofold basic purpose for the magistrate. Not only to punish evildoers, but to praise the righteous. Again, 1 Peter 2. And you saw that right there, didn't you, back in Romans? Well, you're seeing it very clearly, aren't you, back in Ecclesiastes 8. All right, but anyways, 1 Peter 2, notice 13. Therefore, submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake. Go back to what Solomon said. For the sake of your oath to God. That's exactly what Solomon meant back in verse 2 of Ecclesiastes 8. Whether to the king as supreme or to governors. So you can see that there's different hierarchy here. As to those who are sent by him. Listen, here's why they're sent by God. Two reasons. For the punishment of evildoers. And for the praise of those who do good. So what good comes to those who obey the magistrate, who obey the righteous rules and commands of God, of the king? Or to go back to our text, Ecclesiastes 8 and verse 3. Do not be hasty to go from his presence. Do not take your stand. Oh, I'm sorry, verse 5. For he who keeps his command will experience nothing harmful. What good will come to that wise person who willingly and wholeheartedly, for the sake of God, for conscience' sake to God, or again, verse 2, for the sake of your oath to God, obeys or keeps the commandment of the king? Well, one, he's going to have a good conscience. And two, if the ruler is righteous, he's going to prosper in other ways other than a good conscience. The magistrate is to create laws and policies that encourage, yea, rewards, righteous living. Now, this obviously forbids the punishment of law-abiding citizens. And so when we live in a country like ours that's largely turned all of this up on its head, oftentimes you might do right and be punished for it. But nevertheless, generally speaking, I think, well, I know it ought to be, and sometimes is even in our country, those who do right should not only be not punished, but praised. Now, this brings me to this question. And it's an evident and obvious one, and it could take us away on a rabbit trail, but we're not going to go down it. I just want to quickly answer the question, who defines what's right and wrong? Because you have a king whose commandment we're to obey. Well, in the old covenant, it's evident. It's God, right? The king had the laws of God to implement, and the people had to obey. In the New Testament, the answer is God's law. Obviously, there's differences, but nevertheless, it's still the same. God is the one that determines what is right and wrong, and thus the king has an objective standard whereby he's to rule. He's not to create his own morality. He's going to have to make applications of God's law to his people. But nevertheless, it's still the law of God. Magistrates are to govern nations by the law of God as summarily found in the Ten Commandments. which is found in all men in shadow form, even if they don't have the Bible or they rule over a nation that's pagan for generations and generations, even centuries upon centuries, and they've never heard of the Ten Commandments, they still have the echoes of those commandments in their heart. That's called natural law, and that's the substance by which they're to govern their people. That's the morality whereby they're to govern their people. Now, let me show you from a text you know already. Look at Romans 2. And let me begin reading at verse 12. For as many as have sinned without law will perish without law, and as many as have sinned in the law will be judged by the law. He's talking about Gentiles who don't have the law. That is, they don't have it in its written form. But alas, if we keep reading, verse 13, for not the hearers of the law are just in the sight of God, but the doers, verse 14, for when Gentiles who do not have the law by nature do the things in the law. You see, this is why we call this natural law, because man by nature possesses the echoes of the Decalogue. That's what he's talking about here, the Ten Commandments. Because Gentiles who don't have the law have the echoes of the law in their heart. Although not having the law, they have a law to themselves. It's called conscience. It's called the remains or echoes of the Decalogue, because man is by nature the image of God. And to the degree that that image remains, even in fallen creatures, that law remains. And then notice verse 15, who show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and between themselves, their thoughts accusing or excusing them. Verse 16, in the day when God would judge the secrets of men by Jesus Christ, according to my gospel. So everybody, according to verse 16, is going to be judged. That's also according to verse 12. But their judgment will be dependent upon whether or not they had the law or did not have the law. Okay, so think of a pagan ruler who's not only not Christian, but he governs a non-Christian nation that's been non-Christian for centuries. What rule, what standard, what law is he to govern by? Natural law, which is what? The echoes of the Ten Commandments, which basically says that he's to govern in such a way that people can worship God freely and they're to love their neighbor as themselves. This is the essence of natural law, and every ruler, irrespective of how far away removed he is from Christianity, is obligated to rule according to that standard. Okay, so let's say, though, he's a Christian or in a Christian context where he has the law. He knows about the Ten Commandments. He knows about these things in a more particular way. Then he's more obligated to govern accordingly. And he's going to be judged in the day of judgment, according to verse 16 and verse 12, in accordance with his knowledge. Our president will be more criminal in the day of judgment than those rulers who never had the law, because this guy knows what's right or wrong, and yet he acts oftentimes contrary to it. Okay, so to put it simply, the standard used to govern all nations is the law. Either natural law, if you don't have a copy of the Ten Commandments and you're ignorant of true religion, or moral law, that is, the Ten Commandments as revealed in the Bible. But either way, it's still God who determines the morality. It's still God's law that determines what's right and what's wrong. So now we know, quite frankly, when we're to obey and when we're not to obey. Because, again, go back to our text. It says it twice, doesn't it? Verse 2, keep the king's commandment. Verse 5, he who keeps the command, his command, that is the king's, we'll experience something harmful. Rather than how do we know what we're to keep? How are we to know what we're to obey and not obey? Well, when he commands us to do something in keeping with the commandments of God or the morality as found in the law of God, we have to comply. And when he commands us to do something contrary or forbids us something that we're commanded in the law to do, then we're to obey God, not man. Now, I know there's a lot more that could be said, but that's the basic, simple overview of it. So we are to obey, one, because the magistrate's from God and speaks in the place of God as his minister. And two, he's to protect lawful citizens. And thirdly, verse 5b and following, he punishes evildoers. Verse 5b, and a wise man's heart discerns both time and judgment. Now here's where we get to the probably the less clear little section. I don't think it's as unclear as it may be on first reading. I think at verse 5b, he says, a wise man's heart discerns both time and judgment. This is a reason why the wise man keeps the command of the king, because he knows that there's both a time to obey it, and he knows there's a time not to obey it, and he also knows there's a judgment in terms of consequences with regards to our obedience. Okay, so let's say it's a commandment that we're supposed to obey, and we disobey it, there's a judgment for that. Or we could say that God commands us to do something, and the magistrate forbids it. Well, brethren, the wise man knows there's a time. There's a time when he has to obey, and there's a time when he has to disobey. I think both are implied. In fact, I know they're both implied. Because of verse 6, because of every matter, there is a time and judgment. A wise man knows there's a time to obey. A wise man knows there's a time not to obey. And a wise man knows there's consequences for both. There's consequences, there's judgment from God if we're rebellious. And there's even judgment, wicked and unrighteous, from wretched, godless rulers if we stand up for the truth and disobey them. And that's going to bring us to verse 9. There's a time in which one man rules over another to his own hurt, talking about unrighteous rulers. In other words, a wise person knows the purpose and limitation of the magistrate and acts accordingly. Now, this is in contrast to the unwise. Notice how he switches in 6b. Though the misery of man, I take man to be either the wise man who's righteously disobeying the king, his misery will increase greatly. Or else, I think more likely it refers to the disobedient, unwise person that fails to discern there's a time and a judgment. I think it's the latter mostly. Because notice verse 7. For he, that is the person whose misery increases greatly, doesn't know what will happen. So who can tell him when it will occur? Now, by it, I think it goes back to the time and the judgment. And he's contrasting an unwise person with a wise person. The one, a wise person, is prospering because he's obeying God for the sake of conscience. And the unwise person, who doesn't know the time or the judgment, he acts contrary to the laws or the rules of the king without knowing that there's going to be consequences, both temporal and eternal, for his rebellion. And thus, I think by it, he's talking about the misery that increases at the end of 6. And I say that because, verse 8, no one has power over the Spirit to retain the Spirit, and no one has power in the day of death. That is, nobody can keep himself alive if the magistrate puts you to death, or worse than that, God judges you in the day of reckoning. No one has power. Who has power? The king has power. The king has power to put you to death. That's kind of the point of the magistrate, isn't it? To kill evildoers. And brethren, it's such a tragedy, and it's so wretched that our present government is negligent in its foremost primary responsibility. I mean, there was just recently this fella that supposedly killed his wife and his son and did a bunch of other wretched stuff. He was found to be guilty by 2 or 3 witnesses. He should be put to death today publicly. But he's going to what? Sit on your dime and my dime for what? 2 consecutive life sentences? How? How ridiculous. 2 consecutive life sentences. That is ridiculous. Verse 10, verse 11, because the sentence against an evildoer is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is truly set in them to do evil. He should have been examined, not hastily, properly, as the scripture says, by 2 or 3 witnesses, and then he should be executed, ideally publicly. Again, let's go back to verse 7 for a second. For he does not know what will happen. This is a person whose misery increases. This is a fool. He doesn't understand the consequences of his rebellion and or disobedience. He fails to realize that he hasn't the power to keep himself from death. The middle of verse 8. There is no release from that war. What war? His battle with death. There's no release from it. That's one conflict everybody will lose. And in particular, here is talking about the wicked person, because look at the end of 8. And wickedness will not deliver those who are given to it. Wicked people should be put to death. Now, let me give you a text and then we'll come to verse 9. Back up to what he says in verse 24 of Proverbs. 24:21. My son, I think this is a summary of our text. Ecclesiastes 8. My son, fear the Lord and the king. Do not associate with those given to change. That is something not good. Rebellion. For their calamity will rise suddenly, and who knows the ruin those two can bring. I think that's basically a summation, a short, truncated version of Ecclesiastes 8, 2 to 9. All right, verse 9. All this I've seen and applied my heart to every work that's done under the sun. There is a time in which one man rules over another to his own hurt. Okay, so having mentioned the fact that the sword is given to the magistrate to put to death evildoers, and their wickedness will not keep them from it, it will not protect them, it won't protect them from the magistrate's sword, and it definitely won't protect them from God's in the day of judgment, But what is the opposite or the potential opposite of that or potential danger of that? If the government is given, if the magistrate or the king is given a sword and he can put to death lawfully, and if he doesn't, he's unlawful himself. Well, what's the possible perversion of that? Verse 9b, there is a time in which one man rules over another to his own hurt. See, the own points us back to the ruler. There's the one ruling over somebody in such a way that will result in his own hurt. And let me say, there's two ways that can happen. One, I've already said it, negligence. I don't care how wicked our present president is. One of the most wickedest and evil things that characterizes him and them, the majority of our governors, isn't what they do, is what they don't do. And again, we'll see that when we come to verse 11. But I think also here, if not predominantly, it's talking about oppression. Wicked, evil, godless rulers. I think he's saying, this is not I don't want to say a correction, as much he's basically putting a bookend to it. So he starts with obedience, but keep in mind, disobedient rulers will give an account. Disobedient rulers will be held accountable. Philip Ryken again, from what the preacher had seen, whenever one person has power over another person, there's always a strong possibility that it will be used in a destructive way. And again, our friend Edward Reynolds. There are some kings who use their power tyrannically and wickedly, whereby they do not only oppress their people, but hurt themselves by bringing the vengeance of God and men upon their own heads. A few guys did take a little bit of an aside at this point, some of the older guys, and here find justification, not for individual revolutions, but for properly defined revolutions against tyrannical rulers. He goes on, which is here noted partly for the terror of tyrants. Be careful, tyrant. What you give out may come back, and that from the hands of your citizens. And partly for the caution and comfort of subjects groaning under those heavy pressures which they're not able to remove, that they may forbear unlawful and rebellious courses and quietly commit themselves and their cause to God, who judges righteously, and who both can and will call the greatest monarchs to a sad account for all their impious and unrighteous courses. There is a time in which one man rules over another to his own hurt, that is, the hurt of the ruler. All right, so we're to obey the authorities. A couple reasons. One, let me give you these in closing. Because all authority is given by God. The authority given to the magistrates, God-given, and thus to disobey it is to disobey God. We are to obey the magistrate, mindful of the fact that he, God, has ordained all rulers. And thus, if the earthly king commands us to disobey our heavenly king, yes, we disobey him, I've said that, but insofar as his law doesn't contradict scripture and is in harmony with either natural or moral law, then we obey him as if he were Christ. Listen to the words of Ryken. The people of God were obligated to obey their earthly king, talking about the Old Testament, because he was anointed by Almighty God. To obey the king, therefore, was to give honor to God. We honor God the same way. Now he's talking about us. In the exercise of his royal and universal authority, Jesus has appointed the leaders of our own government. Our submission to authority on earth is one important part of our submission to Christ in heaven. Or to use the language of verse 2, keep the king's commandment for the sake of your oath to God. Or to use the language of the New Testament, for conscience' sake. Two, because abusers of authority are accountable to God. Brethren, their authority comes from God, and thus they'll give an account to God. Remember the principle, to whom much is given, much is required. So ordinarily, certainly Paul is, I think, forbidding any type of personal uprising. I don't think he's against all kinds of uprisings, but nevertheless, he's definitely opposed to personal uprisings. And we obey insofar as what he tells us is the truth. We disobey where his laws contradict God's, and we leave his future in the hands of God. He'll be harmed himself, if not in this life, the next. And thirdly, because their praises and punishments are a foretaste or a picture of the future day of judgment. And brethren, this is one reason why unjust rulers are so doubly guilty, because they pervert the character of God and give the wrong impression. That's in my notes. I meant to at this point read verse 11, but I've read it already. They give the wrong impression. You see, putting this man in prison for two life consecutive sentences gives the wrong impression. You can give the wrong impression in a number of ways. One, when you promote wickedness as if it's righteousness, that's giving the wrong impression. When you fail to reward righteous doers, you're given the wrong impression. And when you fail to punish evildoers, you're given the wrong impression. You're perverting the character of God. And that's why what James says about teachers could be applied to all rulers. My brethren, let not many of us become either of them, teachers or rulers, because both will receive greater judgment. An unjust ruler suggests that God himself is unjust. And furthermore, they imply there's no consequences for our behavior. But brethren, we know from Scripture nothing is further from the truth. God himself rules through earthly kings to provide a warning when they're functioning rightly, to provide a warning to evildoers, that there's consequences. See, there's no consequences, right? There's no consequences in our day. The child slaps his mother, there's no consequence. He slaps the teacher, there's no consequence. He slaps the magistrate or the policeman, there's no consequence, and then he does something worse. If there was some form of consequence early on, then maybe he never would have gotten to the place that he did. And then also, of course, when the magistrate's functioning properly and rewarding righteous people, it reminds us, what is this little bit of blessing in comparison to that which awaits us? Remember, the king, the magistrate, is ordained of God. Well, we'll leave it at that.